Hello, welcome to Geek and Biscuits, or should I say, welcome to Frighteners. So today's focus is going to be a film that I would say maybe a little bit of a underrated little movie, but also I think maybe not many people have actually seen the film. It's Peter Jackson's 1996 comedy horror, The Frighteners. So it is a Michael J. Fox is the star of the film, and it is not to give away too much straight away, obviously, because it's for people that haven't heard. Maybe it's kind of nice to go through it in a kind of linear way. But all I can really say is that Michael J. Fox plays Frank Bannister, a kind of psychic medium. People call him a fraud, although he does have abilities, but he uses them as a bit of a con man. And basically, yeah, the film's kind of like a comedy horror where he has the help of ghosts and can see spirits, and he haunts people intentionally. The ghosts do his bidding. He kind of runs around and says, oh, I've cleared these ghosts out for you. And then we see that they're all kind of like in the business together. But then the movie takes a bit of a turn into the fact that it looks like there's a serial killer in the town where they're living. And Frank Bannister then becomes, Frank Bannister, Michael J. Fox's character becomes kind of the prime suspect. Yeah. So, right, before we explain any further, what's your first memories of the film?
I think it was it's discovering early Peter Jackson stuff, because obviously this was before, well, actually, I think it might have been sort of going backwards from Fellowship of the Ring. So I think I'd sort out his earlier stuff. I really sort of stoked for Fellowship of the Ring. So I sort out Bad Taste and Brain Dead, which I think is called Dead Alive.
Yeah, it is.
Other countries, yeah. And absolutely sort of loved that sort of over-the-top, wacky, gory aspect of just sort of splatterfest movies. And then just hearing about sort of Heavenly Creatures, so I went sort of systematically through his back catalogue, and then Frighteners. And I actually think, I believe it's another one that I've watched with you.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, I'm glad you remembered.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah. It's something that we watched over at college together, which would fall in quite nicely with, you know, I think Lord of the Rings came out that first year of college.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it also worked out. So, yeah, it's one of those late night Grant Fest.
We watched it in bed together.
Ooh, we did. Okay.
Yeah, for me, like I said, we used to, I used to know the owner of the video store, Venus Entertainment, where I lived. So we'd be constantly getting movies out and things. And I think it was just like, like you said, college time. It was the era and the like everybody was starting to play with CGI in movies. And suddenly, like, you know... I mean, obviously, you've had there's no internet, as in, like, there's no way everybody's got the internet. It's not as accessible as it was. But there seemed to be at that time, I mean, it might be, hopefully I'm remembering history right, but there seemed to be a lot of magazines like Empire Total Film with a lot of free videos to, you know, every month show, you know, packaged in like VHS videos, which is, sounds really cumbersome now. But, excuse me, you would... by like showing off trailers like Deep Rising, Frighteners, it was almost like we had all this new technology to show off. That obviously Terminator 2 had already shown like maybe 5 years before, but it was now cheaper, more accessible for studios and stuff. So it was almost like it was in your face. So nothing was like inaccessible. It was like even the film I think it's not seen by many people, it was like there on the front like row of the video shop for everybody to see. So yeah, it was just I think a Friday night the family watched it, my mom, my dad, me, my sister, and I think we all like had a really good time. It's really good. And then I can remember just I think I must have purchased the film myself, maybe at college. And then I can remember, like, obviously me and you would, like, watch films together and you'd show me something, I'd show you something. And I can remember, The weird thing is about it, it's going to sound really bizarre. I actually remember the, because obviously, you know, being like living at home and going to college and stuff, I remember sitting back against the wall. We had quite a lot of food. I remember you saying, I don't even remember the colour of the quilt that we had on there. I can just remember saying to you that I really do like this film. I think you'll really like it. It's a little bit like Tim Burton like, but if Tim Burton could be normal.
I think it helped you with stroking my leg at the time.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, and I can remember you afterwards was like, yeah, it's great, really enjoyed it. And yeah, so that's yeah, again, it's not much, you know, it's not wildly different to you, apart from the fact that it was probably the second time or something that I'd watched it. Yeah. But it was I think it's one of those films that you people watch, or the people that I've showed the film have really enjoyed it. I've not really met anybody that's watched the film that's gone, nah, it's terrible.
Yeah, so. it makes you want to share it with people as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It, I think because you're fully aware, it didn't sort of didn't make a big splash when it came out, and you know, it was sort of a title that I'd never, until obviously like sort of going back through the Peter Jackson stuff, and you saying, oh, come on, watch this. It's a, you know, it's a great film, and it's yeah, so it made you want to see it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the video covers back then, I mean, I think we've already spoken in a prior podcast about, there seemed to be at a time that this film was released when you had like Scream, a film called Phantoms with Ben Affleck, and I don't know if you've saw that, and everyone seemed to be like almost dressed in like unidentified dark colours. They'd be head and shoulders and be placed along like the cover. You'd get a lot of that, whereas Frighteners was this like imprint of a demonic face, skull almost like pushing through the cover.
Yeah.
Like, now which one, you know, as a young guy that's interested in horror, what are you going to pick up first?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's intriguing just then. And then the name as well, The Frighteners, it doesn't, I mean, you could almost sort of go off on one saying The Frighteners. It possibly could come across a little Abbott and Costello type sort of, could it be a comedy? You know, it doesn't.
It's very old-fashioned.
Yeah, it doesn't suggest too much either. No. It doesn't give anything away by, you know.
Well, that's it. I mean, one of the, I mean, we'll get to it later, but one of the cameos in the film is by Arlie. I always want to say Emery, but it's Ermy, isn't it? Yeah, from Full Metal Jacket. And he says that, you know, you shouldn't be going around putting the Frighteners on people and stuff. So it's that very old kind of, like you said, it's you know, if you hear that phrase, you're going to be like, well, horror? Maybe. Like, is it a horror? We know it's not. It's actually quite, I would say, quite an element of fantasy in there. In the film, I would say, but it's one of those where you just, like you said, it's got that, what should it should have worked for it, because it's got that almost like intrigue about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean it's a big studio film, you know, Universal.
Yeah, huge.
Produced by Robert Zemeckis, who I think was going to direct originally, and I think they just brought to their attention, but I think Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh started writing the story for it while they were working on Heavenly Creatures.
Yeah.
And I think sent through their agent, their American agent, because they were doing everything based in New Zealand at the time. And somehow it found its way to Zemeckis, who, you know, at that time, still now, I suppose, with the amount of pull he's got. But at that time, Zemeckis is not a name you don't sort of say no to.
No, absolutely.
So Bob Zemeckis is saying, right, we're going to make this film to Universal. Universal will go, oh, yes, please do. You know, so they got quite lucky with it.
It started off, because he should take a lot of credit, because I think it was originally going to feature on an episode of Tales from the Crypt, and Zemeckis was like, no.
All right.
Yeah, I think he was like, this has got to be, it'd be its own feature.
Yeah.
So Zemeckis is like, should take a lot of credit for that as well. And the other thing I read is that I think Zemeckis and everybody was pushing for it to be really held back and released in Hollywood, obviously, in Halloween, Halloween. And they said no and pushed it to summer, where Independence Day. certain things, and it just didn't make enough of a splash.
So I was reading as well, there's stuff to like they filmed it in New Zealand to cut, you know, to help cut costs down. That was part of what Peter Jackson said, it had to be filmed in New Zealand. Yeah. But the condition was they made the town in New Zealand look like Middle America.
Yeah.
And then because obviously before Weta Digital was properly formed, they were sort of like doing things on the fly, effect wise. And I was sort of talk about the main effect in it a bit later on. But they were sort of having to hire out other companies to get finished on time because of that move, because of that.
Yeah, it's which again, it's almost like, I mean, we might as well move forward to that. I mean, like we talk about the story, obviously, and I think maybe that is the meat and potatoes that we get to that. But the effects, it's such a, like you said to me before we, you know, before we recorded, that we spoke about the director's cut very briefly, didn't we? That we've both watched that recently, and that we're saying that some of the shots or some of the extra footage in there just feel a little bit flashy, like an almost like an advert or an excuse to put in CGI.
Yeah.
Now the film, it's dated, it's early CGI, but it almost, some of it or a lot of it really does suit the tone of the film.
Yeah,
I feel so. You don't sit there and go, oh, that is terrible, or oh my god, it takes me out of it. I mean, we've always spoke about effects don't really do that to us anyway, because we appreciate, when I sit down, I'm like, I don't suddenly think to myself, I don't know, it's like me going and visiting my granddad and or grandma or any elderly relative, and you know, expecting, you know, them to do anything the same as me. Like if it's a physical activity, be exactly the same. In fact, you have to put your limitations in place. And so I think that, taking that aside, that me and you do take that into like consideration, I think that I don't think I've, like, you know, when you do watch a film with somebody, don't you, or somebody show a film to somebody and you sit there and you like want their reaction, and sometimes you know people are going to comment on effects or be taken out of it because that is a thing that everyone looks for. But I really do think that adds to the film, the almost like little charm to it, because everything's like very whimsical at the beginning, even though it's threatening, it's got a whimsical side to it. And so, speaking of this as well, we might as well now actually go into the plot, haven't we, where the film opens up, and we open up at like a Tim Burton's childhood home, it looks like, kind of big scary mansion almost, and we've got like a young woman running through the, or a woman running through the halls, and she's being chased by something, and it's not an homage to Evil Dead, because we do see what's chasing her, but it's almost the same kind of like very snappy, very quick, quick cuts. And it's basically, it's like a shape of a person pushing through the floor, then the table. And it's like, again, a showcase of special effects. And then as we get to the top of the stairs, and the carpet, or the thing in the carpet that's grabbing the woman, we then see an elderly woman then shoot the thing in the face with a shotgun, and next thing, like a spirit kind of shoot out at the screen, and then we have the title of The Frighteners in like black lettering with glowy blue, you know, silhouetted into it. And I think that really sets the tone for the film, Dan, because again, it's like frenetic, a bit of intrigue, and very whimsical with the effects, and not kind of hiding anything. It's like, bang, we're there, we're going to make it a little bit on edge, and off we go. Well,
it sort of takes that idea further, because I always look at when you first see the head and hands pushing through the wall, following, because it's Dee Wallace, isn't it?
That's right,
it follows her.
Legend.
Yeah, definitely, and it makes me think of Nightmare on Elm Street, and that when
Freddy Johnny Depp,
it's over the top of, I think it's when Nancy, because she's got the
cross on. Yes, it is. Sorry, yes, I always mistake. No, you're right. I always remember that wrong. I always think it's Johnny Depp before he sucks him in the bed, but it isn't. It's Nancy. You're right. Absolutely.
And they have that. It's just a rubber sheet that Robert Englund pushes his face into.
Yeah.
And it works so well because it's unexpected. And in the remake of Nightmare, they use CG. And it just, it for such a, an effective original effect, you know, how effective it was in the original, it didn't make sense for the remake to do it now. It's forgiven in Frighteners, I feel, because they take it one step further and you start seeing when it's crawling along the walls, you see the full body of this thing.
Yes.
It's not all walls crawling about. It's not just pushing in here and everything. It's a full-bodied apparition that is, you know, pushing. It's almost like it's pushing into our dimension.
Yeah, it can't exist almost, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. So the way to grab her is to be part of something physical, like it goes through the table, doesn't it? Like she's under the table and it comes out from the bottom of the table and then...
Yeah, and that to me, that's if you're going to, you know, marry in CGA to practical effects, unless you've got a, you know, a Jurassic Park-sized budget, an island behind you and, you know, all those amazing effects wizards, you know, I think you have to. It's all CG or nothing. And I think I read, is it right that Frighteners at that time had the most effects shots in any film ever?
I think I've read that. I do believe that. And watching that, like, recently, towards the, what, two-thirds through the film, is there a shot without effects? And not as a criticism, like a George Lucas kind of like prequels criticism that he gets, where there's not kind of anything real around apart from the actual actors. It's just because of how these characters, like, even using, like, I mean, we'll come to it, but like Jake Busey's character, which I don't think we, apart from a couple of like shots, maybe five shots of him at the beginning, five shots at the end, the rest of it he's either covered in a blue CGI glow, or he's either his face is into some dripping mesh, or dripping down at the
gravestone,
or emptied out of a fucking ashtray. Excuse my language.
For me, the bit that I was impressed with the most, the shot that I was impressed with, is later on when Frank, you know, I'll just get into a bit more plot later on, but when Frank is chasing down a cloaked figure, and it's on top of a car, and it looks glow, the wind, you know, it's cloaks fluttering in the wind behind it and everything, it looks beautiful. It's a really nicely sort of rendered shot, that, and I was really impressed with that, and I was just as impressed. Where some of the, obviously early CG, obviously we always forgive stuff like that for being, you know, for the time it came out.
Yeah.
But it is very dated. But I was still impressed. I was re-impressed with this sequence.
And I'm re-impressed that you've re-impressed and brought back re-impressed. So.
I'm re-impressing all the way to this. Yeah.
Most re-impressive. no, you're right. I think the one thing that stood out for me where I look at effects and interested by it, where I think to myself, I can tell that's dated, is obviously there's some effects there. Like when Jake Busey's character is trying to form again into like a solid like figure.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's almost like a, like it feels like a, like maybe a PlayStation 1 era, like cutscene and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, because of the whimsical nature and the very stylized like look of the ghosts and stuff, it's easily could have been intentional.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it is, it's not, but it could have been.
It could have been, but also it makes me wonder, was that handled by another effects house?
Yeah.
Because it was handed out to multiple effects houses. Because you think the sequence where Jake Busey's, when his face is slime.
Yeah,
it's dripping along. That's a really nice effect.
It's fantastic.
But then that goes into the next effect, which is not as polished.
No, definitely not. It does look like a very much like a pre-render, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I do forgive it a lot, because if you think about it, it's 1996 when it's released, so it's even earlier. And when it's shot and they're working on it, and the fact that this kind of like almost like it's like a brown figure, isn't it? It's like the slime almost rejoins, and it's just like a blank like silhouette. And yeah. Michael J. Fox is fighting that. He's interacting, holding it, punching it in the face. So it's not like we're just talking about some static shot that's happening or something. It's environment interaction. A lot of it is and stuff. So it really did push like the boundaries and things like that. I mean, I think like you were saying, you know, Weta Weta, however you pronounce it, I think they had one computer at the beginning and ended up with 25. Yeah. But that's crazy. Yeah, absolutely crazy.
There's a lot of early Peter Jackson techniques. There's miniatures. There's a really nice sort of chase sequence through the cemetery. You know, where the camera sort of moves through miniatures, which he did bigatures for Lord of the Rings. So he's using a lot of techniques he's honed from his earliest stuff, which thankfully into the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But there's a definite moving on. I think in The Frighteners, you see him progressing from his bad taste and brain dead sort of almost student like films. It's obviously Heavenly Creatures, which it was a brilliant fantasy piece, based on true events. And I think this Frighteners was the bridging film.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, giving sort of free rein to do what wants to be as creative as possible on a very limited timescale and budget.
But that's what I kind of meant with my, or alluding to in my comment about if Tim Burton could be normal. It's like you look at Peter Jackson's body of work, that like you said, there is like a development. There is this script flying around that it's like let's get this guy to do this very talented guy, up and coming guy to do this. Whereas, and this is not a go at Tim Burton, but I mean like Jackson had a very, you know, his own style right at the beginning, like you said, almost like it's student-y and maybe a lot of people at the time that were influenced by Evil Dead and certain things. But he's very easily been able to go and move forward and take something like as fantastical as this film. And even in the film show the... Because I always feel that the film starts off really kind of like suspenseful and intrigue, and obviously as we find out that Michael J. Fox's character is a bit of a con man, he's working with these ghosts, kind of quite humorous, but it's probably and then two-thirds through the film I think it gets quite dark, like when we get to the hospital, very dark actually,
switches again.
And he handles that like very well.
It's about as well, but sort of when Michael J. Fox's character, there's a point in the film where he sort of starts believing that he may be the cause of these things rather than it being otherworldly. It goes within himself, and he sort of has a complete shutdown.
Yeah.
And he's there's a bit where he's being interrogated by the absolutely amazing Jeffrey Combs. Jeffrey Combs is waffling on, he's waxing lyrical about all these different cults and about his lead breastplate, what's got the nipples on it, and all these things. And you look at Michael J. Fox, who's like completely broken. Yeah. It's a really nice bit of acting, and he doesn't have to say a thing in that scene.
He's fantastic, Michael J. Fox, because obviously, like, it's quite, keep saying the word dark, but we know him from Back to the Future. And for him to now be this, like, dealing with whimsy, when you read that, the spine or the back of the box for Frighteners, you think, okay, yeah, get it, supernatural kind of bit of comedy in there, I get it. But actually, it takes him to some quite dark places, and some of the flashbacks with his wife and stuff like that, the heated arguments, the alcoholism, and stuff like that, especially at the end in the hospital and things as well, where he's reacting to seeing these deaths that's happened. I think he's brilliant. I think it's one of his best performances. It really is.
Yeah. So I think dramatically, you could say that I mean, there are those sort of comedy elements, his interaction with the ghosts who work for him to do his cons and stuff like that. But his dramatic side, it's, I think the only other time I've seen him, personally seen him do something dramatic was in Casualties of War.
Yeah.
And he's brilliant in that. He's absolutely amazing in that.
He is.
So to balance out when his career has been mostly, you know, it was Teen Wolf, Back to the Future, Secret to My Success, all these sort of almost typical 80s, early 90s comedy fare, you know, Doc Hollywood, you know, that sort of stuff. To then do Casualties of War and then Frighteners, which is a perfect balance.
Yeah, exactly.
Just really showed off his chops, I think, in such a weird and wonderful way. Because like you said, very in a very Tim Burton light, you know, we've got Danny Elfman to do the score.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, it's note perfect for Frighteners, but it's so reminiscent of like Beetlejuice especially. Know, as those it's those beats again. So it's very much a mash of styles and you know, but creatively, it comes together extremely well.
Yeah, no, it's we do this all the time, don't we? We look at films and think like Deep Rising and all, and you know, maybe, well, there's even more coming, you know, for you guys later that we're going to talk about. But I really do feel, I know I say this, but I do feel that The Frighteners is one of those that's so overlooked. It ticks so many boxes. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we can say this now with hindsight, but it is in the hands of a master in Peter Jackson. There's so much creativity. It's like it ticks for horror fans. You've got like we keep saying, you've got every element that you could possibly want. You're not a massive fan of whimsical and stuff. Well, that doesn't matter. That's only part of it. You know, you want to be more serious. Well, just wait till the film kicks off and the plot thickens. It really is one of those films that I do scratch my head and think, how did it not find an audience? Like, how did it not? How did it fail to find it? Because word of mouth is huge, especially back then. And I'm really shocked. You know, really shocked that it didn't do better at the box office. But one thing I would like to say is, you know, when you were talking about the Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, with the effect.
Yeah.
I rewatched recently, totally by accident, Nightmare on Elm Street 2010, the remake. Yeah. And I'm genuinely, I say this with a straight face, I don't think you tell the difference between the Frighteners effect coming out of the wall and the Nightmare on Elm Street, and that shows you, that's not even me crediting the Frighteners, that's showing you that it probably isn't as easy effect as people think it is to have full movement, not to just push it out to a full movement. So maybe I am discrediting Weta or whoever's done it a little bit and saying maybe they did actually, it is better than we maybe thought. Or more difficult than it is. But I just do stand by the fact again that like all this creativity in old films, and a film from 2010 can just be, it'll do. Like that pushed the envelope.
Yeah, so 15 years, you know, 14-15 years of, oh, we'll just do it this way rather than, you know, sorry to go off on a tangent, but I feel like sort of the Nightmare remake was just, I think they just got the script and went, yeah, we'll hit those beats because that's what people liked about the original, rather than doing its own thing. So you have missteps like, oh, let's fully CG this sequence. Do you know what I mean?
It's
up to the point where it becomes completely unnecessary, because rather than seeing something fresh, I feel like if you're going to do something, and this is why I love Frighteners so much, because there's not a lot that's come before it that you could say is similar, and there's not a lot that's happened since, because we've fully entered the world of remakes and reimaginings, you know, to coin a phrase of Tim Burton. So there's not much that's come after that is like Frighteners. So I applaud it for that, for its originality.
Right. Well, I think you probably hit the nail on the head there. I think we can end the podcast now, or review now, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, I do think that, I think you're right, because to me, like, it's all right to say, like, Beetlejuice to me would be the kind of on the same kind of originality, kind of how creative it is, and how maybe it's an audience we've not really, you'd struggle to kind of explain that film to somebody who's not seen it. Now, just because Beetlejuice is like, you know, it's more weird and more like set in a almost like, even this very very stylistic, it's got its style, that's it. But to me, that doesn't take away from Frighteners. That almost kind of elevates my opinion of Frighteners, because it doesn't, it can be set in a recognizable world. It, like I said, that then opens it up for these kind of different themes to run through it. And I think that you're right. I think everybody just wants to go to remakes when we've got maybe the most original film since Beetlejuice.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's sort of, you hit your beats, like, you know, like we've said, Frank's a con man who works with the dead, you know, to con other people out of money.
I mean, if it was just purely stuck to that, right, and the film was like, oh, he's a con man, and then he sets up a house or something, he gets somebody he doesn't like, and then there turns out to be a ghost in there that he has to do battle with, and that's a great enough and funny enough premise, as is.
That's it, but it takes it so much further. So you've got, you know, the traumatic past with his wife, and they go down the whole route of that. If you survive a traumatic event, then your mind is open. So, you know, we can say Frank's, you know, spoilers, but
yeah, we'll do the plot now. Yeah, let's go to it. Yeah,
his wife dies in a car accident that he got because he was drinking.
Yeah.
Someone carved 13 into her head with a Stanley knife. You know, and
because we find out that he has no memory, does he? He has no memory of those 2 hours after his wife died.
And then he, you know, so he's been doing this whole shtick, hasn't he? And then, you know, these otherworldly murders start happening, and people just start dying around this town, don't they? And
yeah, everyone's dropping dead of an heart attack, but when they're opened up by the coroner, there's literally their hearts intact. It's almost like it's been crushed from within or anything like that.
Because I know you like the character Ray. So as you say, what sets the emotion about him, Frank has almost had a car accident and runs into Ray's lawn. And that's where we meet Ray and Lucy, and you quite like the character. So
yeah, no, because Lucy, well, Michael J. Fox, Frank Bannister, he's the con man, he's the main character. So Lucy that we introduced, she's played by Trini Alvarado.
Alvarado, I think.
Yeah, she's in Little Women, I remember her from. She was in that
massive crush on her from this film, but I think it's because she reminded me of Andy McDowell.
Oh yeah, I've not really noticed that similarity. That's
just my Andy McDowell thing.
That's true. Bless you.
It's one of the big reasons.
Yeah, your crush on Andy McDowell is almost as big as your crush on Hugh Grant. Yes, her husband is Ray, and I do forget who he's played by. I've seen him in a couple of films as well. Peter Dobson. And he's this fitness freak. I mean, we're introduced to him, and he's when we first see him with Lucy, he's, you know, before an actual haunting takes place, it's obviously staged by Frank. He's even before bedtime, he's doing all his fitness, his sit-ups, his exercise and stuff, and he's very much like, he's very much into his wife, and but he's very self-centered, and you could tell the marriage is not right. That's it, that's all he cares about is his image. There's just a bit in the film where Mike, obviously, if people who've not seen this are struggling to understand what's happening, Michael J. Fox, Frank Bannister can see spirits after what happens. So he works with two kind of out-of-luck spirits, or three, sorry, out-of-luck spirits. They walk into the house, set up a few things, then leave stuff. He goes in, pretends he exercises it, does like a few little rituals and speaks to him, and then that's it. Con man. And there's a bit where he's like just trying to talk about prices and packages and stuff to get rid of them out of his house. And this Ray, we've just seen, like, just absolutely shout and scream and already had this confrontation with him. He's just like, would you like this? And he's got like a cold compress on his head, and he's just like, I don't give a shit. It's just plays both sides really well. Might not come across as funny if you've not seen the film, but when you see it, his delivery of that line is just brilliant. Yeah, and he actually, rewatching it, he does have quite a big part at the beginning. There's this really quite sad part where, so what happens is when Michael J. Fox has gone in and he's cleansing the house of spirits and things, as he's leaving, he sees Ray has a number on his forehead glowing, like 37 or something.
Yeah.
As you obviously have already mentioned with his wife, we see these people, it's like a number of what person's been killed next, basically. So once 37's gone, the next person on 38 in the forehead. So later on in the film, we discover that he's died, and he, again, another little showcase for special effects where he's obviously like, we see his spirit and he's interacting with Michael J. Fox, which is so great because he's so like worried, and he's like, he needs to take vitamins, and you know, he's convinced that he can still be alive and move back into the house with her, which is hilarious. Spent all the money that she saved. But there's a bit where he's at his own funeral, and he falls into his own coffin, and then he's getting, because obviously he's not used to being a spirit yet, so as he stood in his coffin, as the guy's like throwing the dirt back on the coffin to cover up the open grave, he's holding his hand out to Frank, and yeah, and it's just quite, it's quite comedic, obviously, but it's also quite sad, the fact that he's clearly never even thought about his own mortality. He's supposed to be 29 in the film and stuff as well, and he's just so self-centered. It's like, is it when one of the lines that cracks me up is when people are like going, what's it, Ray may not always have been the nicest of guy, or people may not have always have you know, have whatever thought that much of him, but underneath it all, we believe he had a heart of gold. And he turns around and goes, that's true, and he's crying at his own funeral. He's like, why would he lie at a time like this? And then when he cuts back to him, he's like bawling, he's like, it's a goddamn tragedy.
Oh, it's great.
Is, but he's in it for quite a lot, isn't he, in the first film?
Yes, I've forgotten, yeah, because when they do the, Lucy, Ray's wife, she wants to talk to Ray, she wants to use Frank to communicate with him, and then she takes him to the restaurant that Ray had organised for the
medieval restaurant.
The wedding anniversary.
Yeah.
She forgot about it. Just shows how much she's invested in their relationship.
Yeah, and he's a self-centered one, and he remembers it. Yeah,
which was a nice touch. But yeah, it's that whole sort of sequence when they're trying to talk to, you know, you've got Michael J. Fox and Lucy, Frank and Lucy sat across from each other, and Ray sort of like answering questions, and that's what they said about the money. She's like, I just want to know, where's that 15,000 that I invested? He's like, oh shit. That's little.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah. They start talking about their own stuff, but he's there to be, he gets really fully pissed off, don't he?
Yeah, because after a while she obviously comments, doesn't she, about that, you know, it wasn't great, and he's like, what a bitch. Like that, and he storms off. Well, he doesn't storm off until, because it's Frank tells her that he stormed off when he hasn't. Yeah, because you do get that Frank is a bit of an asshole at times, because he's obviously not very nice as well to the ghosts that he works with, apart from one of them, which is played brilliantly by John Astin.
Oh yeah,
the judge. Yeah. So before we move forward, oh, actually, what he does is he goes to the bathroom, doesn't he? And this is where kind of the film starts to connect things together, and that's where he sees, he's in the bathroom and he sees a, you know, an elderly gentleman walking, and he has another number in his head flashing, like 38, I think, something like that. And he then sees the like you said, the creature, the spirit, like bumping through the wall, see the outline of it coming through the wall in the bathroom. So it's quite a comical moment where he's like, Michael J. Fox is looking in bathroom stalls and the guy's like taking a piss, and he's like looking around thinking, good food. And then out of the mirror comes this, like, it looks like the Grim Reaper, doesn't he?
That's another one of my favourite shots. It's the mirror ripples, doesn't it? And it sort of reaches out and
finds its hand. It's very watery Stargate type, like liquid that he pulls out, reaches into his chest, almost like ends his life and takes his soul. So that explains to the audience straight away, our people are dying.
Yeah.
You know, what's happening is supernatural. This is then tied back into the beginning scene. So that then obviously kicks off what's going on. Michael J. Fox realizes, Frank Michael J. Fox, whichever we do. So that then kicks off. Yeah. So that kicks off. No. So what we forgot to mention is that a lot of the town do see him as a fraud. And it's quite good because he is a fraud, but he isn't. He can obviously see these things, and he sets it up. He colludes with these ghosts and spirits to haunt people's houses. Then they do their job. They walk off. They all get paid, or they can live with him or whatever. So then there's another little subplot of that Lucy's. I think she's a doctor, isn't she? And she's working with Dee Wallace's character and her mum, because she's
it's like social services sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's making a house call, isn't she? And the audience is led to believe that the mum is abusing Dee Wallace, who must be like 40 odd in the film, middle to late 40s in the film, and we learn that she's, when she was like 14, 15, she was romantically involved with Jake Busey's character, Johnny Bartlett, which turns out to be this hooded mask Grim Reaper-like figure that's going on killing. And when they were younger, he worked in the hospital. He is a porter or something, I believe, or something like that. And they went on a killing spree together, don't they? So we have that like plot line, or like, again, we've just told you exactly how it is, but it is handled very nicely. Like, it doesn't reveal itself straight away, does it? We get little hints here, because we're led to believe that the mum's abusing her, but obviously from the beginning we know that the mum protected her from something. So again, there's that mystery's in the air again. And then we have, obviously, what we've not really spoke about is the three ghosts that Frank works with. So you've got one black guy who died in the 70s, so he's almost like Disco. Then we've got one guy. So that's, Cyrus.
Yeah.
And then we've got Stuart, who's like kind of a nerd, kind of high school. Yeah. And Michael J. Fox pushes him around. Baby's haunting. I mean, and he's pissed off. The stunt that they pulled at Lucy and Ray's house. He says, like, his words are like, when he got there, nothing was happening, and the ghosts were like, "Yeah, we pulled us back." Removing the bed. So it is like kind of quirky, funny things that we don't see in kind of any kind of horror film. We don't see why the ghost can only do so much of something, and this kind of is a funny explanation. So I've hurt my back. We've done it all for you. And then we spoke briefly about John Astin plays the judge, and he's kind of a washed up old like cowboy kind of thing, and his jaw's falling off, and he's got no midriff, it's just his spine.
he sort of mentions something, he says, "Don't tell the boys, but my ectoplasm's dried up."
And he's got some great, I mean, he's actually in a lot of scenes that are actually cut from the some of the talking scenes that are cut from the actual cut, but he's kind of like he is the one ghost that Michael J. Fox does respect, really.
And
he warns him, doesn't he, that death's no way to make a living and get out of this business, because obviously since his wife died, he's an architect, Frank is. He's supposed to be building this house for them, and he's kind of lives in a all-completed house with no windows and nothing, does he? And he's obviously still mourning and still suffering from what happened. He's living like con job to con job, isn't he?
Sorry to interrupt, just saying about the director's cut, was about the house, was the little shot of him sawing off part of the framework for the roof to put on the floor. And that's just sort of like how he's living, almost slum-like.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
Definitely. And like the bit where we spoke briefly, but there's a great cameo by Arlie Ermey as the drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket, in the exact same character almost, and he's the drill sergeant that runs the cemetery. So when Frank Bannister comes in, he's kind of like, nope, you're not getting in here. Don't go around putting the frighteners on people. Yeah, and they have a bit of a little fight. And it's just, again, it's just fantastic. And then there is Troy Evans, who's a character actor, who's been in quite a few things. He plays the sheriff, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, and he's probably the only... He's what, sorry?
He's wonderful. He's so lovely, isn't he?
He is one of those characters that you... You just believe he is that sheriff, don't you? Just think they've just gone and grabbed him off the street. That's it. He's not even an actor. That's it. And he plays very well off of the fantastic Jeffrey Combs. He does steal kind of the show a little bit. Yeah.
I would say if you don't watch it for anything that we talk about today, if there's one thing you take away from it, is watch it just for Jeffrey Combs' performance.
Oh, he's unbelievable.
Stand out in that film. He's so good.
So obviously from the sheriff played by Troy Evans, kind of seems to be what the only living person in town that doesn't treat Michael J. Fox like shit. So, but he does reluctantly have to bring him in, because where these murders are taking place, Frank always seems to be around, and the last victim, a lady of the local newspaper that keeps writing hit pieces on him, ends up dying, and he goes in to report this. The FBI have taken an interest in this case, is what we can say. So Jeffrey Combs plays Milton Dammers, doesn't he? Special Agent Milton Dammers. And he's, I don't know if you want to talk about just his appearance for a start. It's just brilliant.
Just before the appearance, the sense is that he feels like he's in control and he's not at all. It's a bit where he tells the sheriff that Frank won't, he's got a passport to be to the nearest airport, he'll be on a boat over to this. We'll never see him again as he's walking in behind him. It's like, oh, you're right, Frank. Milton Dammers, he's so good. He's got this sort of razor sharp haircut,
almost Hitler like.
And the thing is about Jeffrey Combs, his eyes are so brown, they're so deep brown, they're almost black.
Yeah,
which it just adds. He's I don't know.
Well, he comes across, doesn't he? Like when we first see him, he comes into the room because Lucy's there being spoken to, because obviously she was one of the last people with Michael J. Fox, Frank Bannister, and he's kind of like he's so socially awkward, and he like kind of creeps around. So he's like behind the door and he's like hello, and then he like comes back behind the door and then you see him popping out into the frame, and then when she.
The sheriff's like, Milton, will you just come inside?
Yeah, I prefer standing, thank you.
Precisely, what time did Mr. Burns leave the restaurant? Because I don't know, half seven. It's like, and he sort of builds on that. He needs to know, but she's stressed. She starts shouting, and he goes to throw up because women really make him nervous.
And the fact is, what's great about it is that he's in this position, like you said, so you're expecting somebody really authoritative, and he isn't. But he does have a quite like arrogance and confidence about him, but he's also not bumbling, is he? He's a nice mix of he's just all over the place.
It's all about to like when he said, like, at whatever time Frank bought, what was it, Seven Blades on third and Main on the 3rd of October or whatever, and he's going, Seven Blades, 3/3, 7/3, 7/3, 3/7. It's like, Milton, we don't know what you're talking about. You just humbly, it's like, right. breaks his thought. But yeah, you get this. And this is the thing about the director's cut, is that he, in a theatrical cut, you just get a sense that he's an occult expert.
He's been undercover so much, hasn't he, in courts, that he's completely damaged.
But they delve a little bit more into it in the director's cut. And like you were saying before we started chatting about this, he almost goes from a character of mild ridicule, being quite a tragic character, and it's not just in what he said. It's when you, in the theatrical, he tears off his chest, and you do see scars and stuff over his body. But in the director's cut, he goes as far as to explain where he gets, which cult have done what to him. And he's starting to think this chap's there's a very good reason why he's off his fucking nut.
It started to remind me of is it Frank Grimes from The Simpsons?
Grimey.
Yeah, it reminds me of like him times like 20. Like, it's just, because I mean, I think we mentioned it that he even has a throwaway line, doesn't he? That he was the sex slave of the Manson family, and that he was in a cannibal cult that pushed forward the threshold of pain and eroticism like to its highest level. And I do like it though, where he comes back to it, and I will not be broken. so there is some like heroism to him almost, and like nothing can kill him, nothing can break him.
But then he needs a pile ring.
that's fantastic. So obviously he kidnaps Lee. Well, we'll move very quickly through it. What happens is they believe that basically Lucy's the next on the hit list, isn't she? She has a number and a forehead as they're being interrogated. She believes in Frank. That's the only problem the film maybe where it's aged, is the fact that the romance between those two comes very, very quickly.
It's almost instant, isn't it?
And she's just lost her husband. But obviously, it's not. She wasn't invested for a while, it looks like. But she believes in him when he tells her that it's all bullshit, that meeting. I mean, Frank's obviously lying, but. So she goes to visit him in the prison cell. The two ghosts help him escape. He sees she has this number in her forehead, this Grim Reaper-like figure, which is Jake Busey's Johnny Bartlett character, bursts through the wall. So you've got the kind of comedic, almost Scooby-Doo fight in the background, where you see two ghosts pulling the Jake Busey character through the wall, then the next minute you see them coming back through the other wall. and that's they start to figure out, because the two ghosts are killed, so Stuart and Cyrus. Michael J. Fox, he starts to figure out that the only way he can hurt this thing is by being dead himself to fight it. So we get this kind of like out of nowhere, like it's really jarring when he like gets a little pistol out of handgun and that he takes from Milton when they escape the police station, and he goes to shoot himself in the head. But basically what he does is they freeze him.
They lower his heart rate, don't they?
So he basically, his spirit leaves his body and he can go and fight this thing he believes to save her. And at the same time, she's like monitoring his vitals and setting all the equipment to, you know, resuscitate him. That's when Jeffrey Combs comes and he kidnaps her and takes her away from that. So again, we've got two kind of plots going forward. We've got Michael J. Fox or Frank's intent on hunting down Johnny Bartlett, and then we've got as an audience to be worried that he's got 15 or 20 minutes before he's resuscitating or he's fucked, basically. So, and that's where the fantastic, probably like the best shot in the film for me, and with Milton, is where he's obviously handcuffed in the car. He wants her basically nowhere near Frank Bannister. He believes Frank Bannister's killing these people, either by his mind or some supernatural way. And there was a very interesting bit, actually, just to cut to that quickly, where in the director's cut, when he's looking at it through the cell at Michael J. Fox, and he says, oh, these people won't even go to trial. They often suicide. Which, again, is quite cold. It does work in the film, and it works for him, but it's very cold, isn't it? Because the guy's like, you know, there's no evidence or anything, forensics or anything. He's like, never gets that far. So he has seen some shit in his time, and he's right with a lot of things, apart from this time. But as he's got her in the car, and he wants her nowhere near Frank's body so he can't resuscitate her, we see him go into, like, a shot of his hand go into his pocket, and we think, what's he going to get out? What weapon? And it's a pile ring for us. And then, again, usually these throwaway jokes, but I think we talk about them, Dan, because for a film like what's called The Frighteners and all the effects going off, it's just full of everything, isn't it? It's really much like a mystery box. It's full of every little, like, some of it almost feels like some of the stuff Milton does could have been written by Dan Aykroyd. The explanations, the supernatural things. Then we get the pile ring jokes. Then we do you know what I mean? Then we get the whimsical, almost like Ghostbusters Casper like stuff. And
this sort of stuff, like, you know, he's so super serious, like Milton. But then you get those little, you know, he knows people don't like him and stuff. But there's that bit where, like, I think he, they work out, don't they, that it's Bartlett's, like, Jake Busey's ashes, that they've got to get to onto sacred ground to stop him from doing what he's doing. So they're going to take it to the asylum, which is behind Dee Wallace's house. But it's that bit where he comes down, they're about to do it. Coombs turns up again. And because he thinks it's all bullshit, so he lets them out, and they're like, there's this whole sort of, oh my god, what have you done? You complete asshole. He's like, oh, I may be an asshole, but I'm an asshole with an Uzi.
And he shoots him. Because he's convinced Michael J. Fox has created an alter ego, like, and it's really clever, and you can tell that he's worked and probably gone so deep into, like, capturing or like, ending these people or serial killers or whatever that have done all this really bizarre things, and he's clearly an expert, but this is where his, like, arrogance and his brokenness have, like, completely shut him off to what's happening. Obviously this is like 2 seconds from his death scene, because, you know, we'll skip forward, but what happens is Dee Wallace, so as you probably pieced together by our way of talking through it, Dee Wallace and Jake Busey were obviously, she's obviously like maybe about five or six years younger than him, and still a minor. They're having a relationship. He gets the electric chair. He's gone. They got 12 kills together. He's obviously come back, and they continue in their killing spree. That's where the number on the foreheads keep appearing, and it's up to nine. It's nearly 40. So towards the last maybe 20 minutes, Lucy goes back to the home to rescue her from her mum. That's when it's fully revealed, which we kind of already start to figure out anyway, that she's working with, she's not being tormented by her former boyfriend, she's working with him. She ends up killing her mum. Is that right?
Yeah,
she does kill her mum, doesn't she? Yeah, for a minute there I thought she kills herself. No, she kills her mum. And that's where she has his ashes. So that's how they get onto that. And she then becomes the protagonist, the antagonist of the film. Because in the cemetery where Michael J. Fox is, has that out-of-body experience. And I do apologise if anyone's trying to keep track of this, but the film is so frenetic sometimes. It is everywhere. And that is not a criticism. That is, it is a bloody good film, and it works massively in its favour. But he Michael J. Fox is, when he's out of body, as his heart rate's been lowered, this is where he's beating Jake Busey to a pulp, basically, and all the kind of cape and scythe fall away from him and his disguise, and he's literally about to, he wipes it from him and he's about to finish him, isn't he? He's about to kill him. And then obviously Lucy's got back to him and revived him. So that's how he then loses every power to really kill, and it's the emphasis is then placed on Dee Wallace to finish the killings for him, and he can be there in like spirit, literally, to help her out. So she so the last kind of part of the film is where they go back to the hospital, which we've obviously heard and seen little bits of until then, where when Johnny was alive, he was in the hospital, an orderly in the hospital, and he shot 12 people. Well, she helped him, and now she's got the shotgun, and it's role reversal, and she's going around. And what I think's really great about it is we have Michael J. Fox, because of obviously his traumatic past, the fact he can see spirits, as he's walking to get to the chapel that's in the hospital, he starts to then almost like be walking through a memory of everything that's happened.
Yeah.
And from the view of that, really does, it's almost played completely straight then. Throughout the film, we've had so many jokes, so many. I think the only actual kind of comedy moment we get is the death of Milton Dammers, the fantastic Jeffrey Coombs, where Dee Wallace goes to shoot Michael J. Fox, and he intentionally puts his foot through a broken up floorboard and falls through the floor, and he gets a shotgun bullet to the face, and it blows his head up. But what keeps it in context of the film is the fact that we don't just see nothing there and an head explode. We see like head explode, and then his head's there, but it's the ghost of his head, and he's like looking surprised. it's fantastic. Yeah, and then the film obviously comes to a conclusion where they, Frank and Lucy manage to best Dee Wallace and JBC, Johnny. But again, he doesn't take the easy way out, does he? Peter Jackson, they kill Michael J. Fox. Frank,
again.
Yeah.
It's surprising because, you know, it's Dee Wallace as well. She chokes him with the shotgun. But then it's because of the crossing over, isn't it? It's because he's on his way to heaven.
All the murders we've seen, haven't we? We've seen like a ray of light come out, and people have gone into it. And so Michael J. Fox has left, his spirit rips her spirit from her body as he's killed, doesn't he? And he drags her up there. So I'll let you continue, mate. Sorry.
Yeah, it's funny. And it's just like, then there's like a pause because she's screaming for Johnny to come and help her. And it's almost like a pause for Bartlett.
I think he's reluctant, isn't he?
Yeah, but eventually he comes after her, he manages to grab it. But we find out that the tunnels also, it goes both ways.
Yeah,
and all these weird sort of snake sort of tentacles come out, and it's like the corridor of light hardens.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? And it sort of, you quickly realise that this would be the expressway to hell. But then it sort of closes up, and it's this giant sort of
demonic worm.
That goes crashing back into hell with those two with it. Obviously, he gets his second chance. Frank gets his second chance. He gets to come back, doesn't he?
It's quite nice because we get to see the two. We don't get to see the judge again, and I will go back to that scene because I know that we've missed that out, because that's probably one of the best scenes in the film with the judge in the museum. but we do get to see the two ghosts that have helped him a lot, and they've like obviously modernized, and they look really cool, and they come and they give him this nice kind of, he sees his wife again, and she kind of gives her a blessing to move on. And I like it when he says it's time to go home, and he goes, I am home, and they go, it's just not your time yet. And I like that because it's like he's almost like been able to walk in both life and death and work in both worlds, but there is still an eye of power, and it's saying nah. So it gives him that he don't just kind of go back and live, he goes back and lives and knows that he doesn't know everything, there is a point to him living still, and there is a bigger universe. So I really like that about the ending. The one scene I would like to quickly talk about, if that's all right, is the museum. What did you think of? That's probably where the film starts to kick off, isn't it?
Yeah, it just has fun, doesn't it? It's, so you've got your serious bit with is it Magda, the newspaper editor, where the reporter she's berating right at the start of the film, he's dead, and Frank sort of comes in, and then it's sort of like she feels that Frank's queen for her as well. She believes Bannister's doing it.
But he's trying to protect her, isn't he? He's actually trying to protect her.
Yeah, she sees it the wrong way around, doesn't she? And it's, so the police get involved, but the ghosts sort of get involved to help Frank out of there, just as Bartlett turns up in his death guise to come and claim Magda. So there's a lot, again, there's a lot going off, but then you get the sort of, the mummy moving. It's like an Egyptian display, isn't it? It's an ancient Egypt display. So the mummy starts moving and stuff starts flying about. And then the judge comes in, guns are blazing.
Yeah, as he's about, because obviously the police have got Michael J. Fox held there to rights, haven't they? They've got guns on him, he can't move, and he's literally almost, you can see him wanting to leap to help her. And as you said, as death, in quotation marks, turns up, he's about to strike, and then we get a gunshot from the judge, who's obviously a gunslinger back in the day, and he kind of, like, we at the time, he, as an audience, we don't believe it's that easy, but he believes it's killed Johnny, doesn't he? Yeah. He shoots him quite a few times until he kind of disappears, and it's good to see the judge get a bit of a final hurrah. And obviously one of the jokes where he ends up pleasuring a mummy because she has good teeth, because he likes it when they lay still.
Yeah, it's brilliant. But yeah, again, it's a great performance, but it's also great. It's a really good design from Rick Baker, who, he designed it, but unfortunately wasn't available to apply it. But I think that the only sort of the CG, the jaw off when the ghost dog has run off with it when it was introduced to him. But yeah, it's a brilliant. Brilliant design, and like I said, played really, really well by John Astin. It sort of gives that love exposition and it, almost like a mentor figure to Frank as well.
Definitely. Because I think when I first watched it, you could almost feel like Frank does respect him absolutely, but you could almost feel like, is it pity from Frank because of his drying up and his days are nearly done and stuff? But when we see the director's cut, it's not actually, is it, that much wisdom he's trying to impart on Frank and stuff like that. It's really good. And I wanted to just speak about that scene a little bit because it is quite, from a technical point of view, it's fantastic. And it's funny, it's action-packed. But also, it is John Astin's biggest scene, isn't it, in the film? Yeah. And he does stand out there and he is hilarious. Yeah. So
definitely, mate.
So, I don't know. I feel like we've covered it quite in depth, and apologies if it's been quite back and forth, and people do find it odd to follow. But it is one of those films, like we said, like Beetlejuice, where it's like, explain it to somebody that you don't want to ruin the film for somebody. Just explain it to them, because you cannot do it justice until you've seen it. And it's not just about, oh, it's really good. It's about, no, you can't really, whatever you say will not give somebody the idea of tone of the film. It is all over the place and it works fantastic, but it's just so diverse, isn't it, the film? It's great. And for me, I know this is going to be feel like a cop out, but it would have to have the golden biscuit.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to do it twice in a row. Well, I'm not sorry. That means these films are great.
There will come a time when we'll be sort of rating it. We aren't rating stuff. Sort of fall busy, it's three, whatever. As we have a bunch of knife mix. But I think when something is so deserving because of it, and for me, it's because of it's so unique, not in just its payoff, but it's how it was made. It's a film that we, like we said before, that originality we haven't seen in a long time.
Absolutely.
And, data CG aside, you can easily forgive him because of the time it was made.
Yeah,
it still holds up, and it's just it is a really, really good film. So I would completely agree with me. It's another golden biscuit.
Yeah, I do. I think it is, and just to quell anybody's fears, the CGI is dated in places, but like a lot of it, like the ghosts themselves and stuff like that, like when someone gets sprayed with fly spray in the face and it like mushes their face, it's fantastic still. There is some really nice effects still to appreciate in the detail, and I think you're right. Probably there's been a lot of studios do that, so there is some inconsistencies. But if that is the biggest gripe we've got with the film, then I think you can really tell that you're onto a winner.
Yeah, definitely, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, have you got any final thoughts?
Yeah, mate. That's, as
Quite a
always, just
conclusive package, wasn't it, today?
that's it. Yeah, I think it's like, you can always say that. Like we always say at the end, just yeah, go and if you haven't seen, go and see it. Yeah, go and
Yeah.
watch it.
My final thought is the cover for Don't Fear the Reaper. Yeah, just very nice, really. I'm surprised it wasn't used in as many promos for the film or anything like that. So it's
It's the Bottom Birds, I think,
yeah.
which is a New Zealand band.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a nice cover as well. You get some Disney have a thing at the minute of redoing their main songs in a more upbeat sort of funky way. I remember, like, I think what was it recently? I think Frozen 2. They've got Into the Unknown, which is your big sort of set piece song, and then I think Panic at the Disco would do a version of it at
Yeah.
the end. You couldn't get more,
No, of course.
away. And not to say it's a bad song, but some covers work, some don't, and this is definitely one that works.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But you
Absolutely.
can always have more cowbell.
Well, absolutely. And my final thought is to say that I believe that me and you were trying to download legally. I've repeated that three times because it was definitely legally. We were looking at finding that song when we thought that's quite a good, a nice little version to have. And I think it maybe have been, I can't remember now. It was the first Napster. I believe it was Napster. Yeah, we tried and we failed to find that. So the film can't speak highly enough about it, but do yeah, check out that cover as well. So yeah, so well, that's it, guys. We've come to the end of this episode. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Dan, as always, mate.
You're
Thank
welcome.
you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so just give us a like if you like what we're doing. It does help us out, it pushes up us further in the algorithm, means we can get content out, reach you easier. Also means we can start doing better content as well and things like that. So we'd really appreciate that if you like us, of course. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, and unsurprisingly, it's at Geek and Biscuits. So, yeah. That's it. We look forward to continuing our Halloween specials, very soon.
Cheers.
Thank you.